Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, as President Joe Biden begins a three-day visit to Angola in the dying days of his presidency, we take a look at the complicated relationship between Washington and Luanda.
For the first 10 years of its independence, the U.S. was trying to overthrow the MPLA government. And during that period, Angola was very dependent on Soviet support. More recently, they became the largest borrower from China. And I think that President Lourenco has actually made a strong effort to diversify relations.
We'll hear directly from Venancio Mondlane, the man millions of young Mozambicans believe has been cheated out of becoming their president. Also, who is Maxime Tshugulai and what has he been doing in Africa?
I think he sometimes tries to appear with a sort of degree of machoism, you know, wearing t-shirts, sort of showing off his biceps, clean shaved head, posing with manly men and the like.
It's Monday, the 2nd of December. First, we go to Angola. America's outgoing President Joe Biden is on African soil today, fulfilling a promise he made when he met African presidents during a summit in 2022. But the trip comes at a time that political pundits call the lame duck period of his presidency. So why is he spending his last days in office visiting Angola? I think we can guess that it has to do with the fact that Angola has huge natural endowments of critical minerals that the U.S. needs to stay in competition with Russia and China, countries with which Angola has a less complicated history. I'll take you back to when Angola became independent from Portugal after a protracted armed struggle led by various movements, including the MPLA, which has been in power since 1975. The country then became the site of a proxy war between the then Soviet Union and its ally Cuba and the United States and its ally, a white-ruled, white supremacist South Africa. Political power has shifted, but Angola's riches remain. It has oil, it has diamonds, and along with its neighbors Zambia and the Congo, it has copper, cobalt, and other minerals critical for development in the next century. All the powers that be want those minerals. And the United States is involved in building the Lobito Corridor development in Zambia, Congo, and Angola, something we'll be hearing about in just a moment. But let's listen to what the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly McPhee, who's been traveling with the presidential delegation, had to say about this trip.
Well, the president is making good on his commitment to travel to Africa, and there are two main purposes. One is to celebrate the engagement of his administration in Africa. President Biden and Secretary Blinken issued a strategy early on in the administration that basically recognizes that the United States and Africa share many goals, and to work together for mutual security and prosperity, we sought to intensify our engagement. Specifically for Angola, we've seen a dramatic transformation in our partnership. About a year ago, President Lourenco came to the White House and met with President Biden. And the two of them said they couldn't believe 30 years ago that they would be sitting around a table together. So we've done so much together, and we want to highlight that and have it serve as a model for other engagement across Africa.
That's U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly McPhee. President Biden stopped over in Cape Verde on his way to Angola. He met Prime Minister José Ulysses da Pinha Correa e Silva while his plane was refueling. Now for a bit more detail with senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, Whitney Schneidman. We spoke to Mr. Schneidman before President Biden began his trip to the continent today. These are the dying days of Joe Biden's presidency. This period is called a lame duck period because can't do much, can't say much. So I'm just wondering, what's the point of this visit to Angola?
The visit is actually quite important. This is the first time that a U.S. president has visited the continent in nearly 10 years since Barack Obama went to Kenya and Ethiopia in 2015. And Biden will be supporting the Lobito Corridor initiative, which I believe will have bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress, because it's focused not only in gaining access to critical minerals, but it's sort of a new development strategy of working with partners from the EU, from the African Development Bank, from the Africa Finance Corporation, and working on other issues at the same time, such as agriculture, access to digital connectivity, other infrastructure like roads that communities can access for development. So, yes, it comes way late in the administration. Biden promised to go to Africa the year after. He promised to go last year. So it's taken him a while, but I think it will be important to sort of highlight the continent for the American people.
You say Africa, but he's only going to Angola, and there are very specific interests there. So just talk to us about why America is so influenced or so focused on Angola.
Well, the U.S. has a very complex relationship with Angola. For the first 10 years of its independence, the U.S. was trying to overthrow the MPLA government. And it wasn't until the Clinton administration that the U.S. recognized Angola. And during that period, Angola was very dependent on Soviet support. More recently, they became the largest borrower from China. They have some $45 billion in loans. And I think President Lourenco has actually made a strong effort to diversify relations. And he came to the U.S. in 2017 and struck a strategic accord with then Defense Secretary Mattis in the Trump administration, and has worked hard to sort of normalize relations with the U.S. So I think this is a victory. It's an accomplishment for him. And I think it gives the U.S. another strong partner with whom to work on a host of issues on the continent.
This is happening against the backdrop of Russia and China being involved, very, very involved in Angola. So I'm just wondering, is this a continuation of the great game that Angola is playing? Or is this a new iteration of a relationship with the U.S.?
Yeah, I think more the latter. I mean, Angola has very specific objectives. It wants to generate 70% of its energy from renewable sources by 2025. It wants to become food self-sufficient by 2027. It wants to diversify its commercial ties, and the U.S. is going to have a U.S.-Africa business summit next year. So I think this is a very real effort for Angola to get to the next level of its own economic development by drawing more private sector investment into the country from the U.S. and other Western countries.
Donald Trump will be president next year. Will
this is true.
Yeah. Will the interest in Angola change?
There's going to be a whole lot of change in the American body politic. But one thing about Africa is there's been a steady amount of bipartisanship when it comes to U.S. engagement in the continent, going all the way back to African Growth and Opportunity Act being passed in 2000 to President Trump's last administration when he signed the BUILD Act, which created the U.S. Development Finance Corporation and Prosper Africa. So I think there will be a strong element of continuity, especially around a project such as the Lobito Corridor Project, which President Biden is going to highlight. Because this initiative, it focuses on Angola, but it also includes the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Zambia. I think there's an interest to bring Tanzania into it. So it's a multi-country initiative that focuses on a number of interests that are relevant to Republicans and Democrats alike.
I was going to ask you, what does bipartisanship mean? Because our listeners don't necessarily follow the jargon of American politics. But that is exactly what it is, right?
Absolutely.
In fact, just explain this in a little bit more detail.
Okay, so in the year 2000, Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. Congress came together to support the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And this turned the page on the Cold War policy of the U.S. relying just on aid, because the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, was going to use trade as a stimulus for economic development on the continent. So this relationship between Republicans and Democrats, which we call bipartisanship, has endured for the last nearly 25 years, even under the last Trump administration, when the U.S. Development Finance Corporation was created, as was Prosper Africa. So I think it will endure in this Trump administration and will be the basis on which Republicans and Democrats will continue to support projects such as the Lobito Corridor initiative.
So explain to us in more detail what the Lobito Corridor actually is.
The Lobito Corridor at its core is a rail line that runs from the port of Lobito to the border of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And it was first constructed about 100 years ago when the Portuguese were colonial powers in Angola. And it's fallen into disrepair. And so this is an effort, Biden administration, the EU, other African partners, not only to rehabilitate that rail line, but to extend it into the DRC and Zambia so that a port can be created on the Atlantic Ocean for the export of critical minerals from Central Africa, but also to use the rail line as an engine of economic development for communities along the corridor.
Does President Biden have any plans to go anywhere else in Africa or anywhere else in the world? After all, he's sort of footloose and fancy free in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, no, my understanding is that this will be his only stop in Africa and that he will come home after this. As to his other travel plans, I don't know, but I'm focused on his visit to Africa because I think it will actually be quite important, even though he's 8 weeks away from leaving government.
Who else will be going with him? Because usually presidents don't travel alone.
Absolutely. I think he's taking a number of private sector individuals. I know he's taking individuals from his Council on Diaspora Engagement. He's taking other individuals from the Millennium Challenge Corporation. So I think this will be a real effort to bring the American toolkit, as it were, to Angola to help deepen and diversify the relationship.
Angolans complain that they are being dealt with in rather heavy-handed way when they disagree with the government, when they show their dissent. Some of them are in jail, many of them young social media influencers, and they accuse the government of introducing laws that will squash dissent and freedom of information and freedom of speech. Do you think that President Biden will bring that up?
Absolutely. I mean, these are issues in the relationship. These will not be swept under the rug. And a commitment to democracy, commitment to good governance is part of what the U.S. does and tries to achieve. You know, it's highly imperfect. We have our own challenges here in the United States. But nevertheless, you know, these are issues that are very important to the United States. And I expect President Biden will bring them up with President Lourenco.
Will President Lourenco, do you think, pay any attention to it? And would that actually be influenced by the fact that President Biden won't be around for much longer?
We'll see. You know, I don't have a crystal ball on this. You know, we're not going to interfere in another country's affairs on these issues, but I'm very confident that President Biden will raise them, as I'm confident our ambassador in the country does, and that they come up in other meetings with Angolan officials.
Do you think that President Trump will visit an African country?
I hope so. That would be very welcomed. You know, as I mentioned, this is the first time in nearly 10 years that a U.S. president has been to the continent. And in this global environment, we cannot afford another 10 years before our next presidential visit, because these relationships are so important. This is how we get things done. And it's so important that Americans understand why Africa is so critical, not only to the U.S., but to the world. And that won't happen unless we're talking at the top level, you know, mid-level and all levels of government and society.
Okay. Thank you so much. This has been really interesting.
Absolutely.
That's Whitney Schneidman, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. We are heading to Mozambique now, where the political situation remains tense with ongoing protests over the recent election results and the state of the economy. Thousands of young people have been out on the streets in recent weeks, risking bullets and tear gas as the ruling party tries to squelch their dissatisfaction. We've been speaking to the runner-up of the presidential elections, Venancio Mondlane. He's not been seen in Mozambique since the elections. He says he fears for his life and has been, shall we say, discreet about his whereabouts. But he did grant an interview to my colleague Bruno Garces. We began our conversation with the whereabouts of Mr. Mondlane. So how exactly did you manage to get this interview with Venancio Mondlane? He's not quite been on the scene over the last few weeks, even though protests in support of him becoming the next president or the president of Mozambique have been ongoing following the last election results.
Yeah, so it was all down, I'd say, to the persistence of our correspondent in South Africa, Nomsa Maseko, who was chasing him, who was talking to his people. Unfortunately, on the day she had an issue with her voice, she lost her voice because she had been doing several stories all at once. So I ended up being the one doing the interview, as Mr. Mondlane doesn't speak very good English. So the interview was done in Portuguese. We voiced it over. And the interesting thing is that we know for a fact that he was in South Africa. He said that he faced an assassination attempt while being there. We don't know exactly, therefore, if he is still there or if he has left to another country because of security reasons. Neither him nor his people are disclosing where he is right now. The interesting thing, though, Audrey, is that although he is away from his country and he's not being able to be there to attend the mass protests that have been taking place for various weeks now, he is, in spite of that, very confident that the current administration led by Frelimo, the ruling party that has been there in place for nearly 50 years, is seeing its very last days.
How did he explain that? What did he mean?
He attributes that to their handling of the economy and so many other matters that have been taking place in the country right now. Let's listen to it.
The levels of poverty in Mozambique used to be around 46%, and now it is 65%. Therefore, we have around 21 million Mozambicans living below the poverty line. It is absolute misery. We have one of the worst rates of kidnapping in the world, one of the worst rates of press freedom in the world. How is it possible that people living under such conditions, that 60% of them would vote for a party that led them into this condition? Only if it were masochistic people, and the Mozambique people are not masochistic. Therefore, it is absolutely impossible. And Frelimo knows that. It knows that social discontent is massive.
So I challenged him a little bit on this because we have been seeing protests for several weeks in a row now. And so far, the ruling party, Frelimo, doesn't seem that keen on making any form of important concessions. And I asked him whether he really thinks that this strategy of calling for mass demonstrations is really working or not.
Look, we have been protesting, let's say, with some interruptions for about a month. We started on the 21st of October, and now we are at the end of November. And I don't believe Frelimo will be able to resist 1 month more. When we started the protest, Frelimo's position was that this was a crushing victory. They used different terms, crushing, convincing, asphyxiating victory, and so on. As the protest became more intense, Frelimo issued a public statement saying that it was open to dialogue, negotiations. Frelimo knows that if these protests carry on, there's a huge risk that the country will become ungovernable.
So from what I understand, from what analysts have been telling us, people are protesting because of a whole range of things, and he's not necessarily at the forefront of it, that these protests are spontaneous, they don't have leaders, but they definitely are in large measure in support of him. So what's his next plan of action?
I think his plan of action is one that involves other players. So he believes that the protests need to carry on, and that's a sacrifice, as mentioned, that the Mozambican people need to make in order for things to change. But that also needs to be combined with diplomacy, diplomatic efforts, and efforts by the international community. And that's something that I asked about him. I pressed him a little bit on how exactly does he expect the international community to come in? What action is he expecting from the international community?
My message goes out to the international community, especially for those who have closer relations with Mozambique, such as the European Union, the Commonwealth, the G20, the United States, Italy, England, and Germany, and all the countries of ECOWAS. All this community, I would ask them to look to Mozambique deeply and fondly. The situation in Mozambique is not strictly an electoral situation. What happens there is a deep violation of human rights. To tell you the truth, I don't even find it important to get a position in the next government. What I want is for these commitments to be ensured. so that I can say that my mission before my people has been fulfilled. Now, whether I become a minister or a vice president tomorrow, to tell you the truth, that is not important. The most important is to provide assurance for the future of the people of Mozambique.
Did you ask Mr. Modlane about the fact that so many people are in danger? You know, the army has stepped in, the police, people are being shot at. What did he say about that?
I think he was somewhat vague on that. What he did say is that there is a balancing act right now in Mozambique. And in this balancing act, he believes that the people have the upper hand. He thinks that it's the government that's losing power and won't be able to cling on to power for much longer. But he does believe that sacrifices, personal sacrifices, are needed. And he even said that he himself wished that he could be there with his people, because he has held mass mobilizations before when he was running for the equivalent of mayor of Maputo back in the day. And it was a challenging act that he did at a very great personal risk for his own safety. And I think he somewhat assumes that people who are taken to the streets are willing to do the same.
That's the BBC's Bruno Garces. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now for an insight into how countries peddle their influence abroad. Russia has long been active in Africa, as have other Western countries. In recent years, one of their most notorious political operatives has been a man called Maxim Shugalai. One of the ways in which his work has been highlighted has been through a series of action movies, a bit like James Bond, the fictional British spy.
Шугалей приговаривается к расстрелу.
Надеюсь, что это скоро закончится. Ливийская национальная армия выбьет всю эту мразь из Триполи.
Да долбанись сюда!
Твою мать, приехали.
У русских денег много. Они заплатят, не переживай. Поступила информация, что террористы захватили двоих русских ученых в Триполи. Наш долг – вытащить их оттуда.
Если тебе больно, ты можешь встать на колени.
Махсин, пошел.
Я убью твоего друга.
Валить отсюда надо, иначе сдохнем.
Родной, мы сюда работать приехали. Да, Самир?
Да.
That's the trailer for the first of a series which follows his exploits in Libya. But Maxim Shugalai was in the news recently because he was arrested and deported from Chad along with two other Russians. Our colleagues at BBC Russian have been looking into why he was arrested and what sort of influence Maxim Shugalai has had in Africa over the years. Gleb Borshchevsky is with BBC Russian. My first question, who is Maxim Shugalai?
That is a very good question, because the answer is going to depend a lot on who you ask. So if you asked Shugalai himself, he would tell you that he is a sociologist, a political scientist who goes to various African countries to study the local political climate, and sometimes just to promote Russian culture. If you ask independent investigators and journalists, they will tell you that he is an agent of Russian influence, that he is some sort of a spin doctor who is working to dethrone pro-Western regimes in Africa and install pro-Russian ones. If you watch movies about Shugalai, they will tell you that he is some sort of a badass action hero who is not necessarily working to promote Russian interests, but just navigating the disastrous political climate in Middle East and African hot zones.
Okay, well, let's look at what he does actually on the ground before we make up our minds about exactly who and what he is. He first operated, apparently, in Libya. What was he doing there?
Well, just to be clear, that is the first deployment of his that we know of. It is highly likely that he had some prior deployments before that, and he had many deployments that we are just not aware of. Frankly, the two of his most notorious and famous deployments are the ones where he got caught and put in prison. So he was arrested in Libya back in 2019, working apparently to promote the pro-Russian regime of Khalifa Haftar, who back then was a staunch ally of the boss of the Russian Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Apparently, Shugalei was promoting Prigozhin's interest in the country. He was arrested by the opposing regime. Prigozhin himself apparently sponsored a trilogy of TV films to not only whitewash Haftar's regime, but also to promote the image of Shugalei as the Russian who comes to the rescue of the Libyan people and tries to bring some sort of justice to this tumultuous country.
So first known and discernible operation in Libya, in Africa. What else has he been doing?
Well, unfortunately, as I mentioned, we are not familiar with all of his deployments. Some he does report himself. Just earlier this year, he went to Angola to promote Russian culture, as he himself said. In May this year, he also went to Chad, where he monitored the election there and heavily promoted the presidential campaign of the current Chadian leader, Deby. Coincidentally, he was also arrested in Chad this year, apparently for some sort of disinformation campaign against Deby, which is quite interesting indeed.
Well, I suppose it shows you that things are very fluid in Maxim Shugalei's life and also in that region where Russia is very, very active. How influential, though, is Maxim Shugalei in these operations? What has he actually achieved?
So I think it is important to note that his influence is not necessarily independent. It depends on whom he is working with. For the longest time, Shugalei was working for the Wagner Group, or rather an organization that was affiliated with the Wagner Group, which is a Russian mercenary group that had a lot of ties in various African countries from the Central African Republic to Mali.
And led by Yevgeny Prigozhin, right? Who died.
Yes, that is correct. So before Prigozhin's death, prior to the year 2023, Shugalei was heavily affiliated with Wagner Group working in Africa. So then the question is, what happens to Shugalei after his mentor's death? We know that Shugalei is still operating in Africa. We know that he is still promoting Russian interests. We can suspect that he is doing some shady stuff, like the things that I described in Chad. We do not quite know whom he is working for right now. After Prigozhin's death, a lot of his media empire, which Shugalei was a part of, he had a foundation that was part of that media empire. This empire collapsed. The organization headed by Shugalei still exists. So it is one of the very few survivors of the collapse of Prigozhin's empire, his businesses. We do not know whose interests directly it now promotes. He could be working for the Kremlin itself. He could be working for the remnants of Wagner Group, which do exist, although on a much smaller scale.
The arrest in Chad and the switching of sides, what do you think it tells us about what is happening in Chad and the politics that are being played out?
Chad has for a while played this sort of will-they-won't-they game with Russia, where traditionally Chad is believed to be a pro-Western country with strong ties to France, as far as I'm aware. But recently, Deby has held several talks with Vladimir Putin. He has entertained the notion of potentially having some sort of agreement with Russia on military cooperation. And among all of these potential rumors of Russian integration into Chad, we see Shugalei not only visiting the country, but later being arrested in that country, just several months after he was apparently very supportive of Deby's regime. Now, the reasons behind his arrest in September are up to debate. Officially, I don't think there was any report that stated the reason. Analysts speculate that it could be linked to a sort of a bargaining chip for Deby. It could be used to show Putin and show Russia that, hey, look, I'm not going to be completely subservient to you. I have some independence. The Russian media, in particular the Russian foreign broadcaster RT, I believe, claimed that Shugalei was arrested on behalf of the French police. But that just seems like some sort of an attempt to shift the blame and, muddle the waters a little bit.
Now, I'm curious about Maxim Shugalei. What sort of a person does he present as? You know, James Bond is a dashing, handsome, clever man that is able to fight his way or talk his way out of any situation and is very charming. Of course, we know that James Bond is a fictional character, but we're talking about a real man here in Maxim Shugalei. You know, is he handsome? What kind of qualities does he have? Why are you laughing?
I'm not quite sure if I'm the best judge of whether he's handsome or not. I think he sometimes tries to appear with a sort of degree of machoism, you know, wearing t-shirts, sort of showing off his biceps, clean shaved head, posing with manly men and the like. But then on some video messages, which he sometimes records for his social media, he almost appears timid in a way, which could be a play, really. But I think that's a remnant, perhaps, of his Prigozhin ties. It is very, very hard to tell. He is most likely not a James Bond-type figure. He is most likely not an action movie hero. But then again, it is also very unlikely that he is just some poor sociologist who is only really timidly interested in studying the local political climate. He is probably something in between.
It's really fascinating, all these people. And of course, they operate for different countries in different countries all over the world, right?
I would assume so. I think this is an example of shadow diplomacy, of cultural diplomacy. Whether this goes into more nefarious area of actually, you know, meddling with elections and trying to topple regimes from within, that is frankly, not easy to tell. There have been reports of Russian actors, perhaps Shugalei among them, going as far as to bribe political candidates in Africa. I think it was in Madagascar. A lot is happening behind the scenes, a lot that we do not know about. This look at Shugalei really is just a glimpse behind the curtains.
Thank you so much. As I said, fascinating. And thank you very much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Gleb Borchevsky, my colleague from BBC Russian. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson and Victor Silva here in London. Frenny Joey toiled away in Nairobi. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of quality. Nick Randell, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. And a quick reminder that you can catch us on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.